From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, photographer Roy DiCarava. His pictures of Harlem spanning the last half century and his photos of jazz musicians are featured in a touring retrospective, which is now at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Also, Elvis opened for them, the Everly Brothers were inspired by them, the Byrds recorded their music. The Louvin Brothers were one of country music's greatest vocal harmony duos. We feature an interview with Charlie Louvin. And John Powers reviews the new film The Apostle, starring Robert Duvall. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The work of the great but under-recognized photographer, Roy DiCarava, is collected in a touring retrospective organized by the Museum of Modern Art in New York. The exhibition is currently on view in San Francisco. It covers a half century of his photographs of Harlem and of jazz musicians, including Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, and John Coltrane. DiCarava was born in 1919 and grew up in Harlem when it was a center of artistic and literary life. In 1952, he became the first African-American photographer to win a Guggenheim Fellowship. It enabled him to spend a full year taking pictures of daily life in Harlem. Roy DiCarava is currently a distinguished professor of art at Hunter College. Terry spoke with him in 1996. One of his Harlem photos from 1952 is called Man Coming Up Subway Stairs. The man looks as if he's returning from a long, hard day of work. He's wearing a rumpled shirt with the sleeves rolled up and the top button unbuttoned. He's carrying his jacket. He's biting his lower lip as he walks up the stairs. Terry asked DiCarava to talk about taking the picture.
I was working 9 to 5, and I used to, like everybody else, I woke up in the morning and went to work and came home, and I was tired. And I was very much aware of my fellow riders and their appearances and their feelings. And I thought, in a sense, that this was a remarkable experience in the sense that these were the people who went to work every day, worked hard, and their lives were rather circumscribed, and in many ways they were borderline in sense in how they lived. And in a way, I thought that their consistency and their perseverance was in itself a rather heroic thing. And there were so many of us that I wanted to find a symbol for that kind of strength in the subway. And there was no doubt that I would, when I decided to take a picture, that I would find one that would come along. And so what I did, I established the hours from 4 to 6. So I had to find a place. So I opted for the entrance or the exit of a subway. But it had to be one of those subway stations that have disappeared, but they had a kiosk, which is this overhead covering, and the walls were made of glass, wired glass, and I managed to find one, believe it or not, with a hole in it so that I could stand on the side and wait for this gentleman or person or woman to come up the stairs. And he eventually did, and he was perfect.
What made him perfect?
Well, he had all of the things that one associates with being tired and yet constant. I mean, he was determined. I mean, he was determined to get home, or maybe he was just determined to get up at the top of the stairs because he was very tired. And I sensed that when I saw him through the corner of my eye down at the bottom of the stairs. And to prove it, when he got to the landing, he rested, which gave me a chance to put another roll of film into the camera, because at that time I only had one exposure left, and I was debating whether I should wait until he got there or put in another roll. So when he stopped to rest on the landing, I was able to put another roll of film in. And so when he got there, I had plenty of film to case. I needed to take more than one. But fortunately, I only needed that one anyway.
Now, did you ever find out who this man was? And did he ever find out that you took a now celebrated photograph of him?
No, I don't think so. People generally, I don't know. I really, I'd have no idea. This was taken a long time ago, and I've never had any anybody say anything to me about it, so I imagine not.
I'd like to ask you about the photograph that's on the cover of your Museum of Modern Art catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a picture of a woman walking down the steps, taken, I believe, in the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And the photograph ends at about her, just right above her waist. Mm-hmm. So basically you see her coat, you know, the bottom half of her coat. You see one mm-hmm. arm, you see two legs sticking out from under this long coat. We have no idea who she is or anything about her. But in a way, it reminds me of the kind of image I see a lot, like if I'm looking down or if I'm looking up, but I'm not looking up far enough to see a person's whole body. Tell me why you framed it this way. Why were you just seeing the bottom half of her body?
Well, because the body talks to you. The body says things to you. You don't have to see a face to know. You can see a body. A person's way they carry themselves. Every individual is unique in that sense and in every sense. So that there's, I guess, for want of a better phrase, it's body language. The body tells you, your feet, your legs, how you walk, how you stand, how you relax. They tell you things. And they can, you know, if you look and have the patience to relax and have an empathy with something other than yourself and yourself, because you, in a way you're mirroring yourself. You're seeing how you feel. And I thought that this was a very beautiful moment. It was a very delicate kind of image of a woman, definitely a woman, and it was beautiful. I liked it.
One of my favorite of your series of photos of jazz musicians is a backstage photo. It's during a session break with the Ellington Orchestra, mm-hmm. taken in 1954.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's such a beautiful composition of repose and disarray.
Right.
Because it's backstage, you know, in the center of the photograph is a coat rack. On either side of the coat rack is a jazz musician. They're each facing in opposite directions. They're each facing the wall. They're sitting on folding chairs, each reading something. I can't tell whether it's, you know, sheet music or the newspaper. And there's, you know, folding chairs kind of scattered around and a lot of overhead lights.
Right.
But it's such a...
You have good eyes.
Oh, thanks. It's such a kind of quiet moment.
I understand. I feel the same way about it. You know, one of the things that is important to me is that one doesn't have to be so literal and so narrow in one perception of music. Music is a very broad category, if you will. And the musicians, to me, are very important. So it really is not so much about their playing singularly, you know, photographing, playing something, but it's about my interest in them as people and how they respond to what they do and what they do, you know, like when they relax or when they go somewhere. You know, the idea that musicians are entertainers and then after they're entertaining, they disappear. They don't disappear. They go home. They go to their families or their friends, and they eat like we do. So I'm interested in all of that. And their resting is certainly one that is very important to me and very beautiful. You know, it's not just the act itself. It's a kind of a perception of them in their total environment as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
One of the things I really love about your photographs is the lighting. Many of your photographs, I'd venture to say most of the photographs of yours that I've seen, are really pretty dark with very subtle shades of, you know, grays and blacks. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly a work of art. It's not reality. This looks different mm-hmm. than reality because of the lighting.
Right.
And I'm wondering what inspired you to go for that very dark, atmospheric lighting that almost reminds me of certain film noir.
Uh-huh. Well, it's first of all, I have to confess that it's what I like. I love the tonal scale, the photographic scale, which means simply the range of tone from black to white. It's so unique. There's no other process that can give you this kind of tonality. And I'm in love with that. And I find the best way to get to deal with that is to not think of it in terms of black and white in a graphic sense, you know, the way a woodblock is or an engraving, but as a tonal scale that we're dealing with. And I love to see that. And in addition to which, when I photograph, I accept the lighting conditions, whatever they are. And I try not to say, well, you can't photograph that because it's too dark or there's not enough light. I don't believe in that. I believe if I can see it, I can photograph it. And I accept the outcome in the sense that it is black and white, and that in itself removes it from reality. And a lot of the things that I do, for instance, are in the subway, and the subway is not exactly daylight, and people, even in people's homes, in terms of the technology, the film is sensitive, but it, in order to really show it, you have to really print it what I call full, and that tends to be on the dark side. Let's say if, you know, 50% is this and 50%, it tends to be more on the dark side of 50. And that doesn't bother me at all. In fact, it gives it a luminosity that you can't get by printing normally. And what we consider normal is the information. In other words, one of the things that one gets in a photograph is information. And I would rather sacrifice the information in terms of details and things like that mm-hmm. for a feeling of mood.
Yeah. Did you resist color when color came
about? I didn't resist it. It just didn't attract to me. I was never attracted to it because I didn't... at first, I didn't like the garishness of it. The color, when it was first introduced, was very garish.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not like that. And even when it's been... You know, now it's pretty... You can get all kinds of tonalities with color now. In fact, it's gotten to the point where every manufacturer has a different idea of what color is, in the sense that they manufacture their film according to a color standard, which is rather arbitrary, because you'll have 10 different manufacturers, and their color scale will vary. So it doesn't lend itself to the kind of control that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
But the main reason I don't use it is because it particularizes too much. It's very difficult to do a color photograph without thinking about color first, and
right.
not what the photograph is about. Because color tends to be arbitrary, especially when you're dealing with human beings who dress up brightly when they're feeling sad, and when they're feeling bright, they may have on a black suit.
Roy DiCarava speaking with Terry Gross. A retrospective of his work is currently at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. We'll be back with more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Back with Roy DeCarava, a traveling retrospective spanning nearly a half century of his work includes his photographs of daily life in Harlem. Now, what was Harlem like when you were a child?
Oh, it was very different than it was now. It was more relaxed. It had a kind of stability to it in terms of people living there. I remember that there were two avenues. There was 7th Avenue and Lenox Avenue, and those were the two main thoroughfares. And 7th Avenue was really the avenue which had the most affluent people and tenants living on 7th Avenue. Yet Lenox Avenue was the busiest one. Both of those avenues were very wide and very exciting and filled with people, and it was different. Now it's almost like I go up there now and I'm appalled. It's like a bombed-out area in some senses because of the houses that are vacant and broken down and, you know, I mean, it's an incredible change from what I knew.
Now, I know your mother moved to New York from Jamaica when, I believe, she was 17.
Right.
And she raised you as a single mother. Was she very determined that you would succeed? Did she push you?
No, she protected me, which is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
She cared about me, and she was very, she was really very concerned about me and very attached and caring. And she wanted me to do things. I mean, she loved music, so she wanted me to be a musician. And she loved the violin, so she wanted me to play the violin. But I remember the turning point in our relationship, I think, her perception of me, was when a teacher from the public school system came to my house and told my mother that I was very gifted and that she should encourage me because the teacher was very encouraging. She had bought me a paint set and was very much concerned with my future. And she took the time to come to my house and talk to my mother about me. And I thought that was I look back now, and I can hardly see that happening nowadays. But it was a beautiful thing, I think, on the part of the teacher. And my mother took her seriously, and from then on, she encouraged me to do and be what I wanted to be, you know, which was to draw and to pursue that avenue.
Now, in one of the catalog essays for the catalog of your photography show, it explains that you were drafted in 1942 and that you had a terrible experience. 43, okay.
Yeah.
But it says you had a really bad experience in the military and that you were in a psychiatric ward for about a month and ended up with a medical discharge. What happened? Did you have a nervous breakdown?
I guess you'd call it that, yeah. And it was the conditions of... I hate to even think about it. Just very uncomfortable and very mean and destructive, not only to me, but to so many black soldiers. Because at that time, there were two armies, you know, one was black and one was white. And the only reason for the separation is to treat black people different from white people. And that's what happened in the army. And in the army, there is no such thing as democracy. And you had to do what you were told, and they tried to break you down and make you a soldier, you know, which was something that went against what I was. So I had a difficult time, but I'm glad to be out of it, and I no longer have nightmares.
How did being a soldier go against who you were?
Well, because there was no... Well, because it was... You had to do things. You were forced to do things that you had really no interest in. And I didn't like the idea of killing people. I didn't like the idea of being killed. I didn't like the whole destructive thing that the army is made for. It's made, you can define it as protection, you can define it as this and that and the other, but the end result is about killing and not be killed. And that was too, that to me is not a very civilized position to be in.
So what was your month in the psychiatric ward like?
Well, it was where I learned about democracy.
What do you mean?
I mean, it was the only place in the whole United States Army where we weren't segregated. So we weren't really the crazy ones. It was the people outside who were crazy.
That's interesting. So did it change your sense of yourself when you got out of the Army? Did you see yourself differently than you did before you got in?
Yeah, I valued myself more.
That's interesting, because you think that kind of experience would kind of break you down and that you'd lose self-esteem.
Well, if I stayed in there long enough, I probably would have. And that's what I was fighting against.
So tell me about coming out and feeling like you valued yourself more.
Well, I just looked at the sky and I looked at the ground and I said, hallelujah. I was free to go and do as I please and to pursue my life in a way that was constructive, you know. I didn't have to learn how to shoot and how to do this and do that. And I felt that I could live. No one told me when to get up. No one was overtly cruel to me and mean and authoritarian. And no, it was wonderful to be free, to get up in the morning and be responsible for yourself.
What kind of subject matter would you say interests you most now in your photography?
I think what it's about is my feelings. I mean, I've come to the conclusion that it's what I look at and it's how I feel about things that really is what I'm dealing with, not so much the subject as how I feel about the subject. And the subject can be anything, depending how I feel at that moment. So that really it's about my perceptions that I'm really trying to express. And my perceptions are the same perceptions that other human beings feel. So therefore, I have a kinship with that.
Well, Roy de Caraveau, I want to thank you very much. And congratulations on your show.
Thank you. And I hope that you liked it, and I hope that people liked it. And I was glad that I was invited to talk about it. Thank you.
Roy de Caraveau, talking with Terry Gross in 1996. The touring retrospective of his work is now at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art until April 14th. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If I cry when I kiss you, when we say goodbye, don't laugh, don't laugh.
Coming up, the harmonies of the Leuven Brothers, whose records topped the country charts in the 50s and 60s. We'll feature an interview with the surviving brother, Charlie Leuven, who re-recorded their biggest hits. And John Powers reviews The Apostle.
I beg of you, my darling, please don't laugh if I cry. If I say I've always loved you and I will till I die, don't laugh, don't laugh.
the best. Don't laugh, don't laugh. And if you will take the chance, I know my love will stand the test. Don't laugh, don't laugh. I could never find another, there's no use for me to try. I beg of you, my darling, please don't laugh if I cry.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Elvis opened for them. The Everly Brothers were inspired by their harmonies. The Byrds and Emmylou Harris recorded their songs. The Louvin Brothers are considered one of the great vocal harmony duos of country music. They were popular at the Grand Ole Opry and well represented on the country music charts from the late 50s until the mid-60s when the act broke up. Brother Ira was killed in a car accident soon after. Charlie Louvin has continued to record and to perform at the Opry. His latest CD, The Longest Train, features songs that he first recorded with his brother.
When I stop dreaming, that's when I'll stop loving you. The worst I've ever my life, the first time I ever wanted to die, was the night when you told me you loved someone else, and asked me if I could forget. When I stop dreaming, that's when I'll stop.
Charlie Louvin with harmonies by Barry and Holly Tashian. Terry Gross spoke with Louvin in 1996. She asked him if it was difficult to sing alone without his brother after his brother died.
I'd always believed that any song's worth singing is worth putting harmony on. And of course, I had grown used to that for the 23 years that my brother and I had worked together. And even today, 34 years after he's gone, when it comes time for the harmonies to come in, I will move to my left, because my brother and I always just used one microphone. And so you had to share the mic. And I even today, I will move over to the left to give the harmony room, knowing in my mind that there's no harmony standing on my right. But it's just old habits are hard to break.
The harmonies that you created with your brother, I think were based on the Sacred Harp singing that you used to do in church. Would you describe those kinds of harmonies that come out of Sacred Harp singing, or what's also known as shaped note singing?
I'm not sure, Terry, that I can describe them explain them where they'd be understood. It's just something, I don't have any musical learning. What I know and what we did is came natural for us, because we was raised in a family that went to these sacred harp singings with regularity. There's things that I can't explain to it. They're doing five-part harmonies, and most people today thinks that four is the limit when a quartet sings, that they've got all the parts, but the sacred harp our shape note singing people used five harmonies, and some of them are extremely high with the ladies' parts, and none of them as low as the quartets practice today. It would be like a mid-range bass part.
How did you take the five-part harmonies that you were familiar with from church and adapt that to a two-voice style? What did you use from that? I guess what I'm really asking is, how did you work out your harmonies with your brother?
My brother adapted a harmony that he thought sounded good, and it was always good enough for me. I remember once our A&R man asked my brother, and that's not or actually he told him, he said, "That's not really tenor you're singing there on that song, is it?" And my brother said, "What, you don't like it?" And he said, "I didn't say I didn't like it. I just don't think it's, you know, like regular tenor." My brother said, "Well, I really don't know what it is. I just thought it sounded good, so I put it in there." And that's kind of the way that we, us being raised together, if it was obvious that the song was going to get too high for me to sing in a certain place, my brother just automatically take that high lead, and I would do the low harmony. We didn't have to step on each other's foot or wink or bump shoulders to do this. It was just something that you knew was going to happen in the song, and you'd go ahead and change to a part that you're capable of doing.
Your early recordings were gospel tunes. Many of them were originals. In fact, why don't we hear one of those originals that you co-wrote with your brother Ira? This was made in 1952, and the song is called "The Family Who Prays."
Broken shall stand. God will say, "My good faithful servant, the family who pray never shall part."
Satan has parted fathers and mothers, hearts with his envy and hate, heading their pathway down to destruction, leaving their children like orphans to stray.
The family who prays
It's the Leuven Brothers from 1952. Chet Atkins featured on electric guitar?
Yes, Chet recorded our first Capitol record with us, and Chet is a big part of the Leuven Brothers sound, from The Family Who Prays right on through to the end of the Leuven Brothers career.
You were singing a lot of gospel songs early in your career, but I know your brother Ira had the reputation of being a heavy drinker and of having quite a temper. Did you share the same religious convictions? Did you live with the same kind of values, or was there a big, big difference there?
No, a lot of us know better, but we don't do better. He knew better. He is extremely well-versed on the good book as far as knowing what was right or wrong. He just wasn't able to conquer the devil, I guess, we didn't have any major problems with the drinking until, I'd say, not end of 1958. The Leuven Brothers records, the sales slowed down as all other country artists did in 1958 because the music was changing. And so our producer told my brother, "I believe that it's the mandolin that's keeping the Leuven Brothers records from selling," which had always been a featured part. My brother worked hard to become proficient on the mandolin. And when this producer, namely Ken Nelson, said this to my brother, and my brother feeling that Mr. Nelson was a close friend and a trusted friend, he believed him. And so he would never play his mandolin again on a recording. After that statement, if it would come up, somebody would say, "Oh, I think this would sound good with the mandolin." My brother would say, "No, let the piano do it or let the guitar do it. Anybody, but I'm not doing it." And it caused him to drink extremely heavy, and he went, between then and the time he passed away, went through three wives and just lots and lots of problems that he never could whip.
Did you start losing dates, too? Did he get a reputation for drinking a lot?
Unfortunately, Terry, if you're half of a duet, one person in that duet don't ever get a bad name. It's just the Leuven brothers did this.
Mm-hmm.
The Leuven brothers did that. Anything he did, good, bad, or indifferent, I was in the minds of the promoters and the radio stations and what have you. I was as guilty as he. And it was no way that I could change that. The only way I could change it would be for us to not to be together. And that finally happened in August 18th, 1963. I just, we had gone from a pretty good career from early the 50s, the song The Family Who Prays, right on up through our recordings, we had done quite well, and we find ourselves in 1963 on the bottom of the totem pole, playing very few dates, and because promoters, the men who spend the money for the TV ads and the radio ads and the newspaper and rent the building and all this, they don't buy problems. With everything running as smooth as possible, they'll still have enough problems to drive them halfway batty. But if they know that any particular group is more apt to cause them problems than they are to be straight that day, then they just won't buy them. And that's what happened to the Leuven brothers' career.
My guest is Charlie Leuven. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Charlie Leuven, his new CD, The Longest Train, features solo versions of songs he first recorded with his brother Ira when they performed as the Leuven Brothers. I want to play another original gospel song that you recorded called I Like the Christian Life. This is really a beautiful song. Graham Parsons loved this song and used it on the Byrds album Sweetheart of the Rodeo. Do you remember writing this?
No, I don't. Things went and come in the Leuven brother career. Sometimes my brother would be a totally good man. He could have been a preacher if he wanted to. He was that knowledgeable of the good book, and he had the gift. But my brother was the gifted songwriter. I came up with the ideas. If I could give him a title and a few words of the story, he could write it in 5 minutes. So this is the way we worked. I don't specifically remember the day that that song was wrote, but I remember that my brother was attempting with all of his might to live a Christian life. So at that time, and the statement was made, I like the Christian life. He thought that might make a song, so what you're about to play is what he got just from that title.
Let's hear it. And this is from Charlie Leuven's new album called The Longest Train.
My buddies tell me that I should have waited. They say I'm missing a whole world of fun. But I am happy and I sing with pride. I like the Christian life. I won't lose a friend by heeding God's call. What is a friend who'd want you to fall? Others find pleasure in things I despise. I like the Christian life.
That's Charlie Leuven from his new album, The Longest Train. Did friends ever mock you for trying to live the Christian life?
No, but I wouldn't say they mocked. When you're not living the Christian life, you have one set of friends. And if you're going to profess to live a Christian life, it's obvious that you're going to have to change friends. You're going to have to change a lot of habits, old habits being hard to break. Sometimes it can't be done. So if you prefer to hang around with your old friends, there's a good chance that you'll drift right back into doing exactly what you are trying to get out of doing.
What was your reaction when you heard I Like the Christian Life performed by the Byrds?
Well, I liked it. It was different. It was lazier. Didn't have the fire in it that the Leuven Brothers had in their arrangement. But I enjoyed it. Graham Parsons also recorded The Cash on the Barrelhead. And the biggest favor that that Graham Parsons ever did for the Leuven Brothers is when he introduced Emmylou Harris to the Leuven Brothers sound. And he played this song for, I don't know exactly which song it was, but her remark was, "Who is that girl singing the high part?" And Graham said, "That's not a girl, that's Ira Leuven." And so Emmylou did a big favor for the Leuven Brothers music catalog. I guess it's about 500 songs in all, and she recorded five or six of them, which I appreciate. I know Ari would have too.
In fact, I think one of the songs she recorded was If I Could Only Win Your Love.
That was her kickoff song for her career. And I guess she thought a Leuven Brothers song was a good luck charm for her, so she recorded Every Time You Leave, When I Stop Dreaming, and a couple of the gospel songs.
Why don't we hear the Leuven Brothers 1958 recording of If I Could Only Win Your Love?
If I could only win your love, I'd make the most of everything. I'd proudly wear your wedding ring. My heart would never stray one dream away. If I could only win your love, I'd give my all to make it live. You never know how much I'd give if I could only win your love. Oh, how can I ever say how I crave your love when you're gone? Oh, how can I ever show how I burn inside when you hold me tight? If I could only win your love.
That's the Leuven Brothers, recorded in 1958. And that recording is featured on an anthology called The Leuven Brothers, When I Stop Dreaming, that was issued by Razor and Tie. You can hear a little bit of early rock and roll influence on there in the instrumentation.
On which is that?
If I Could Only Win Your Love.
Well, that was 1958.
Right.
You know what the influence was then?
Oh, you can hear it on the piano.
Oh, you're not old enough. You're not.
Oh, yes, I am.
Remember Elvis? Are you?
Oh no, not at all, not at all.
No, but we worked a lot of dates on the road with Elvis. Elvis Presley.
How did you feel about the sexuality in his performances?
Oh, it didn't bother me. My brother worked out a perfect impersonation of Elvis. He said Elvis is the only man that I'd ever seen that could wear his clothes out from the inside instead of the outside, you know. So it was kind of funny when it was happening. I like many other people, I thought it was a fad. It was just a fad that people are going through, because I'd seen fads before come and go. And then I visited Elvis's mother, my wife and I did, in Memphis, and I seen ladies old as my mother and some older on their knees reaching under Elvis Presley's fence just to pull blades of grass so they could take it home and say it came out of Elvis's yard. Then I knew it wasn't a fad.
You and your brother broke up the Leuven Brothers and went your separate ways in 1963, and it was, I think, just about a year later that your brother and his wife were killed in a head-on road collision, and I think it was the driver in the other car that was drinking and that was responsible for the crash. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. It happened in Missouri, halfway mark between Kansas City and St. Louis. My brother was coming home from an engagement that they had been on in Kansas City. And the other two people was going from St. Louis to Kansas City to celebrate Father's Day. They just started celebrating it too early, that's all. They didn't wait till they got out of that car.
How did it change your life when your brother was killed?
Well, I had already become a solo artist, so to speak, Terry, and I had released, or Capitol Record people had released, I Don't Love You Anymore, which went to the number one spot. And I believe the second song was Think I'll Go Somewhere to Cry Myself to Sleep. It was doing good at the time, and my brother kind of felt that somebody had done him wrong, but I hadn't. Music is the only thing I knew, and so naturally I would try to stay in the business, and because he had sworn to me that he was getting out of the business. However, he was making attempts to get back into business. Had a couple of records released for Capitol Records. Neither one of them had done anything, but I'm sure that if he would have been given time, he'd have figured out what the public wanted, and that's what he would have gave them.
You're still performing with the Opry?
Yes, ma'am.
How long has it been?
I'm almost finished with my 42nd year.
Wow.
In February next will be my 42nd anniversary, and I'll start into my 43rd year with the Opry, and I'm really hoping that it'll work into something regular here soon.
Right.
Charlie Louvin from a 1996 interview with Terry Gross. Charlie Louvin is performing tonight at the Grand Ole Opry. Next month, he starts his 44th year there. Coming up, a review of the new film, The Apostle. This is Fresh Air. The Apostle is the new film written and directed by its star, Robert Duvall. It's the story of a Southern evangelical preacher and his journey to salvation. Our film critic, John Powers, has a review.
The Apostle begins with an extraordinary scene. Robert Duvall is a Pentecostal preacher who's driving down the highway when he spots an auto accident. Treating this as a godsend, he goes to one of the cars, whose driver is clearly in terrible shape. Even as the cops order him to step aside, he keeps talking to the dying man, urging him to accept Jesus. He's so busy saving the driver's immortal soul that he shows not the slightest concern for the man's bodily life. And by the time he triumphantly finishes his spiritual exhortations, we find ourselves wondering, is this guy a minister or a madman? The preacher's name is Euless Sonny Dewey, and when the movie begins, he seems to have it made. He's got a big parish in Texas and a family he adores. But he loses it all when his wife, played by Farrah Fawcett, has an affair with another minister. These two conspire to get Sonny driven from his own church, and in his rage, Sonny lashes out, walloping the other man with a baseball bat. Suddenly a wanted man, he makes a journey into the wilderness, eventually winding up in Bayou Boté, Louisiana, a small, predominantly black town. There he does various odd jobs, and more important, seeks redemption through good works. Calling himself the Apostle, he attempts to reopen a closed church and begin preaching again. For Sonny's devotion to Christ isn't something so shallow as a mere calling. It's a direct personal relationship, as is clear when, his whole life collapsing, Sonny talks one-on-one with the Lord.
Give me a sign or something. Blow this pain out of me. Give it to me tonight, Lord God Jehovah. If you won't give me back my wife, give me peace. Give it to me, give it to me, give it to me, give me peace. Give me peace. I don't know who's been fooling with me. You are the devil. I don't know. And I won't even bring the human into this. He's just a mutt, so I'm not even going to bring him into it. But I'm confused. I'm mad. I love you, Lord. I love you. But I'm mad at you. I am mad at you. So deliver me tonight, Lord. What should I do? Now tell me. Should I lay hands on myself? What should I do? I know I'm a sinner and a once in a while woman, but I'm your servant. Since I was a little boy, you brought me back from the dead. I'm your servant. What should I do? Tell me. I've always called you Jesus. You always called me Sonny. What should I do, Jesus? This is Sonny talking now.
The Apostle was a labor of love for its writer, director, and star, who financed the film out of his own pocket. The result is something of a one-man show. This isn't altogether a bad thing, for Duvall is a genuinely great actor. Although usually at his best in supporting roles, like Tom Hagen in The Godfather or Kilgore in Apocalypse Now, Sonny is probably his strongest lead performance, a lived-in characterization that comes complete with a goofy, bounding walk. Duvall gives us Sonny without ever passing judgment, making us feel that we're seeing a man in all his many-sided complexity, as a wounded cuckold and a hellfire preacher, a short-order cook, and a happy worker for the Lord. Although Duvall lacks the dazzling charisma of a world-class Bible thumper, he's no Jimmy Swaggart, it's a memorable piece of acting. But like so many actors who direct movies, Duvall is far more precise in creating his own character than in imagining the world around him. The movie's filled with unanswered questions, like, how did Sonny's adulterous wife manage to steal the church away from him? Or, how can Sonny keep making credit card calls without the police ever noticing? More damning, none of the other characters have a tenth of Sonny's depth. This is downright aggravating in the case of the black characters, who are at once sentimentalized, they spend far too much time grinning sweetly, and stripped of the power to act. They seem to have been waiting for Sonny to come and build them a church. Yet despite such artistic sins, The Apostle is well worth seeing, because it does something that our movies almost never do. It takes religion seriously, treating it not as a foible or a kind of grandiose hypocrisy. Sonny is not Elmer Gantry, nor is his flock portrayed as a bunch of suckers. Rather, Duvall offers us a world that will seem exotic to many viewers, but perfectly normal to millions of others, especially in the South. A world in which the Gospels matter more than CNN or Vanity Fair. A world whose inhabitants daily feel the real presence of God. The Apostle is a movie about men and women who, each time they sit down to dinner, know for sure that the Holy Ghost is sitting right there at the table.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Sarah Scherer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.